Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Word down your way. Those who are about to tour salute you.
Well, welcome to another Word Down Your Way. I remember back in 1982 asking the man who's just joined us what drove him. And the answer was whiskey and porridge. And it's clearly worked because only now, 42 years later, is he announcing a farewell tour. Fish, it's lovely to see you again after all this time.
And you. As I said, when the cameras first came on, I said, it's like a series of Black Mirror. People meeting up, whatever happened to the music business?
Yeah, absolutely.
This is what could have happened, and this is what really happened.
Yeah. Where are you now? Where do we join you?
I'm speaking to you from a town called Haddington in East Lothian in Scotland, which is just south of Edinburgh, and I've been here since I left Marillion in 1988. I moved up here and just to get away from the whole kind of London vibe thing and reestablish myself. But I bought a farmhouse that had a bunch of outbuildings, and it was one of the drives, actually, because it was like when we were in Marillion, we spent fortunes on residential rehearsals and writing sessions and stuff. And I knew that when I left, I had to get a property where I could basically bring a band together, and it developed, you know. So I got the house, it had outbuildings, and, you know, my kind of spectral kind of mind took it right all the way down into, like, let's build a massive international recording studio, which was a concrete albatross around my neck for a number of years.
But sure.
Yeah, but then it was, it's, yeah, so I kind of...
I've seen broadcasts from there, because you used to do a thing, didn't you? Funny Farm Kitchen?
The Funny Farm Kitchen Garden. That was,
that's right.
They had both huge gardeners. And but I've been doing a thing called Fish on Friday that's been on the go for 4 years. It's funny, yesterday was the anniversary of the last gig I did, which was the first gig on the UK tour that was supposed to happen in 2020. And we did the Lemon Tree in Aberdeen, and that then we shut down. And what happened was that 2 weeks or so after it, or a week and a half after it, the guy who did the website said, maybe you should do a little broadcast to tell people what's happening. We did it on a Friday, and I used to work as a DJ on Planet Rock for a while. And I had a program called Fish on Friday. So we went, okay, let's do it on Friday. Let's call it Fish on Friday and do it at 6 o'clock. And we started doing this all the way through lockdown. And it just, it was brilliant. And it was great for people. I mean, at its peak, we had about 100,000 people kind of tuning into it. And it became something a lot more than just a singer, talking about music and anecdotes and these funny stories and stuff. And it was like, I realized that, you know, we were actually touching people and really helping some people out. And we kept it going, and we were going to monetize it. And then I decided not to. I think because, I mean, in all honesty, it was like during lockdown, I found a lot of things out about myself. And doing Fish on Friday got me through it, because for that one night a week, for 2 hours, I could switch on and be the entertainer and be what I was supposed to be. And it was like going into the gym in a way, right? Mm-hmm. But doing that 2 hours, we were kind of, it was just amazing just doing what I'm doing now. And I got so used to doing it.
Well, we're going to talk about your I suppose, call it retirement in a sense from entertainment in a moment. But first, we want to just go back to the very first shows that you saw as a kid. Can you remember the first bands you ever saw?
Yeah. The first band I saw was Yes on the Relay tour at the Usher Hall.
Oh, wow.
I paid £1.25, or my dad paid £1.25 for a ticket to the Gods. And I went back to see, I wanted to go and see them 2-3 years ago. And I was going to phone them up and I go, like, you put me on the guest list. I went, no, I'm not doing that. Right. And I thought, I'll buy a ticket. And I looked at the ticket, £80.
There you go. Funny, we interviewed Steve Howe just the other day, and Dave and I were saying that we'd both been to see Yes in 1971. He was really touched, wasn't he, Dave?
He was really thrilled
that we'd been there.
Amazing thing about tickets prices is that when you went to see bands in those days, going to see them live was cheaper than the album.
It was less
than half the price of the album, probably.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that's the thing that's utterly, switched around.
I saw Yes on the Sunday, and that was on the Relay tour. So that was, 1975, I think it was. And then on the Tuesday, I saw Genesis, the Lamb Lies There on Broadway tour.
Oh, wow.
They were, I think, 25 pence more expensive or something. Right?
What can you remember about those shows? Can you remember anything about the impact it had?
I remember being absolutely blown away. I mean, all I did was listen to music in my room on my own, and, it was stereo. And then you were suddenly there in the experience. And, I was away up in the Gods, but with the Genesis gig, I was down in the stalls. And that was a phenomenal gig. And I was a big fan of both bands by that point. I'd started listening to them in about 1972 or so. I think it was 72? Yeah, 1970, 71. So when I was listening to Fragile and Trespass and all the early bands. Because, when I went to high school, I was too big and too gangly and, I had puppy fat, right? And I was never going to fit into the fashionable outfits of the day, right? And, forget Bowie and Slade and T-Rex. I was a fan of T-Rex, right? But, I was never going to forget fashion. And then progressive rock came out. And it was all the kind of guys like me that were kind of geeky kind of guys going to progressive rock. And that's where I went, And like I said, I think my artistic senses kind of took me into that area. And I was really comfortable in it. And that's what I wanted to sing, and I wanted to write words, because words was my thing. And progressive rock was where it led me, because progressive rock allowed you to write loads and loads of words.
Right.
What were you reading at the time? Were there novels and stuff you were reading that was kind of pointing you in that direction too?
It was like Edgar Rice Burroughs. There was nothing, I wasn't a kind of high eyebrow reader, it was all kind of, it was like Sven Hassel and stuff like that. There was some Western guy, I can't remember the writer, but it was I wasn't kind of reading poetry. I wasn't a Wordsworth Keats guy or anything like that. And I wasn't reading William Blake or anything. I started to read a lot more as I got older. But it was escapism. That was why, like I said, Edgar Rice Burroughs, it was like always escapes of the imagination,
So what was the first thing you ever did yourself on the stage? Can you remember?
Yeah. I played the Golden Lion in Gala Shields, and that was in 1980. I think it was April 1980. And it was a covers band, and I got up to audition for them. And I'd gone up and they said, well, what do you want to play? And I went, well, can we do that? I know what I like, or can we do this? And they said, you may have noticed, but we don't have a keyboard player, right? And I ended up singing all this stuff that I didn't really know, which was like Rye Cooder and Steely Dan, which I knew. And then...
God, that's extraordinary, doing Steely Dan in a covers band at that age. That's complicated music.
Well, you see that age, but, I was 20-year-old. I was 20-year-old at that point.
Yeah.
21. Because I wasn't like the Robert Plantisms, just starting off with like a blues band and singing and when I was 12. I was really late when I started singing.
Yeah,
And it was like I said, it was like Rye Cooder. It was silly. Bands I didn't even really know at the time, and it was a great introduction for me because it took me into like different genres, and I was already in a different genres. People said, like, oh, I'm just progressive rock. When I was just at the Faces, I loved the Faces. I loved the Who, right? I was into Deep Purple, Zeppelin of sorts. Like, I mean, they were all back. They were all part of the whole kind of list of the material that, I was kind of immersed in when I was a teenager. And that came through in kind of what I do now. And what I, you know, I mean, Marillion was like a lot more straighter down the line, progressive. And I wanted Marillion to be far more of a rock band than they were. I mean, I wanted to go into Quadrophenia territory, you know, but the band were never doing it. And I remember speaking to Steve Roderick quite a few years ago, and I said, like, I went to see them, and I said, like, it's like having a Humvee and driving in the dual carriageway all the time. You know, it's like, you know, why don't you go off road sometimes? And it's just not what they do, you know.
So like, how did you meet the rest of Marillion? Because you were in Scotland.
Yeah. I was a forestry worker for 4 years. I was studying an OND in forestry, and I was working with the Duke of Buccleuch at Bow Hill, which is where I met the band, Bluett, which was the cover band that I joined, the pub band, right? And I was only with them from kind of April, May, and then I left the forestry in about, I think it was about August, when I was supposed to go back to college for my last year. And I started looking at adverts, and I can't remember, it was Musicians Weekly or something. It was a paper, a weekly paper that came out, and it was all like bands looking for drummers, bands looking for da da da. And I came across a band down in Retford.
Oh, no, Nottinghamshire.
I didn't even know where Retford was, sir.
Retford, right, the home of the Porterhouse.
Yes.
An awful place. And I went there and I met Dizminute, who was a bass player, and we tried to get a band going together. I couldn't get it. Long story short, we ended up in the Scottish Borders, and we tried to get a band going up there, which is impossible, right? Progressive rock band in Scottish Borders, right? And we ended up seeing an advert for a band in Aylesbury that were looking for a bassist singer. And we phoned them up and said, would you take the two individuals rather than the one? And they went, yeah. And we went down in January 1981 and drove down to Aylesbury, and we auditioned, although it wasn't really an audition. It was like, we're already in. As far as I was concerned, we were already in. And then it was like, it went from there. So January 81 to September 82, we did all these gigs and wrote material and signed to EMI in September 82.
What were they called then, that band?
Marillion.
So they were called Marillion already, yeah.
They were used before that, even for that Silver Marillion. They hadn't done anything. I mean, you know, we all lied to each other, right?
But it was like, really?
I knew Robert Plant. Robert Plant was my best mate, you know?
Yeah.
Mike Heron lives. The guy that was in Bluett, the guitarist in Bluett, was a guy called Frank Usher, right? And Frank Usher became the guitarist in my first ever solo outfit in 1989. And I said to Frank, because he is a brilliant guitarist, and he was stuck away in this little band that played, but he lived on a row of cottages down in outside Inner Leithen in the borders near Peebles. And in this row of cottages, that was where the Incredible String
Band. That was their commune, wasn't it?
You've got it. Yeah. And Mike Heron lived in number one. And I got to know Mike and all the rest of it. And so when I auditioned for Marillion, oh, yeah, Mike Heron, big mate of mine. Like, and Mike knew Robert, obviously, knew all these people. So I was citing all these people that Mike had talked to me about in the night over a cover.
It's interesting, isn't it? It's a very bloke thing, isn't it, that? It's like boys at school always slightly exaggerate about who my dad knows, or
my dad
killed loads of people in the war, or whatever. It's intriguing that blokes wanting to join rock bands kind of do the same thing.
I mean, Marillion sold thousands of T-shirts, right? And like, they did all this. We went there, it was bollocks. I think they played a gig in a farm trailer in a field once, right? And then we went down, but we took off. And the thing was, Steve Rothery, the guitarist, had moved down from Yorkshire, and I moved down from Scotland, right? And the two of us really wanted it to happen, right? And I had my drive, and my dad had said, you know, if you don't get it together in 2 years, you got to promise me you'll go back to forestry. And I went, I'm not doing that. So I was going to make it happen. And like I said, you know, and during lockdown, I discovered a lot of things about myself, and I now know why everything happened back then. And I was just driven. When I was bullshitting my way into agents in Wardour Street, you know, trying to talk our way on a Greg Lake support tour. I didn't even know what a support was. I didn't know what to do. All we had was a Comer van, right? And it was like that. And I was managing the band, and I just learned it. I had a book, and it was by, I can't remember what the name of it. It was called How to Become a Pop Star or a Rock Star. And it could have been Lindsay DePaul or something like that. And it was like, and it was, it had all the basics of what you needed to do.
I bet.
Yeah. And I followed.
Can you remember some of the points it made?
Find an agent. Yeah.
There's always a market for a thing like that, because there's always people who just want to know the basic stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And everybody acts as if they already know it, and they don't.
Yeah, and I was all pre-Google, obviously.
Yeah, quite.
I mean, it was like, you know, find an agent to get your gig. So we had Wasted Talent, we had Bob Gold at Wasted Talent, we had a couple of other people that were getting gigs for us. Find a press guy. And I went out and got Keith Goodwin, who used to work with Yes, ironically.
Right.
And things like that. And we built it together.
So it built up quite quickly, didn't it, Marilyn? I mean, you were the first kind of new prog group, is that right?
I hated that shit. It was like, you know, like, oh yeah, new wave of progressive rock. It was like another way to sell papers, you know. And it was what happened was that when the punk movement had come along, which had arrived very, very late in Scotland anyway, right? And when it came along, it was like they made it out as if nobody was interested in progressive rock anymore, right? And yet Genesis was still selling arenas, right?
Yeah, sure.
Yes was still working, Floyd was still working. But they tried to make out that nobody was interested. And suddenly we came out, we're playing pubs in Buckinghamshire, and I've got my painted face, and we're playing this kind of, you know, very Genesis, like, you know, hands up. You know, I mean, it was like, it was very based in that 1970s kind of progressive rock thing. And people loved it. The kids loved it.
Uh-huh.
And there was, so we had a lot of people our age that were in their 20s that loved that type of music. They'll come along and see it live again. And then there was a whole new generation that was going, well, we didn't really like punk. And there was another generation that was kind of, because the new wave of British heavy metal had just kind of washed up on the shore. And people wanted something just a little bit more complicated. And it was like people that followed Rush liked Marillion and things like that. So that's kind of where we came in.
I think the Weekly Music Press were aggrieved because they thought they'd kind of wiped out prog. They sort of announced that prog was over and it's now all about the skids. And when they discovered that prog was still going and actually really, really popular, they were just furious and kind of took it out on those bands, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, yeah. But I never saw ourselves as being, you know, kind of standard bearers. I mean, Marillion were Marillion. I wasn't interested in any other bands. I mean, we just did what we did, right?
Yeah.
And then, I just, my attitude was, I just drove it, you know? And it was, and the other guys were quite happy for me to kind of do what I did. And it was, and we moved all the way through in 82. And that's when we got stuck, because we needed management. We got to a certain point and we really needed to get the deal. You know, we had to find the record deal. We had to find some sort of, we had to get some financial input to take it to the next stage. And that was when, you know, we eventually met John Arneson. I mean, there was a lot of people came along. I mean, Pete Mensch wanted me, he said, yeah, I'll take you, but I don't want the rest of the band. And, you know, he was Def Leppard and stuff.
Yeah.
And I said, like, you know, I said, no, I'm with the band, and we stuck together. And we had a great gang mentality. And that was when we found John Arneson, and John Arneson was kind of at that level, and he took us into EMI and signed to Charisma for our publishing, and then bang, first album, and then we were off. You
know? Yeah. So what was the biggest gig you played with Marillion?
In my history with the band, probably we did a gig in East Berlin, which everybody lied about the size of the audience, but we reckon it was probably 200,000 there. It was a free show in East Berlin. It was a rock gig in Atomkraft. It was an anti-nuclear gig. And it was right. It was in 1988, and it was just before I left the band as well. You know,
right.
I mean, before that, probably it was supporting Queen at Mannheim, and that was again a couple hundred thousand. Well, the promoter said it was only, you know, it was only 150 or something like that.
You and I last met, I think. Maybe we've probably met since then, but in Poznan in Poland,
in
1987. And this is obviously just before the wall came down. And so I remember meeting you in a hotel bar where you'd been paid for the gig in zlotys.
Oh, yes.
Which was the largely worthless Polish currency.
Yeah.
And you pretty much put all the zlotys on the bar and said to whoever was behind the bar, just let us know when we've drunk that. Of course, there's no chance of you ever drinking it at all.
Yeah. It was either that or buy crystal at the airport.
Yes, absolutely.
The crystal shop before you went through, because you were not allowed to take slotties. It's really weird because you know, I'm emptying the studio because we're doing the move this year. And I actually found an original poster from Poznan in 1987.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so, and it was, I framed it. And it's it'd been up in the attic. Yeah, that was, I mean, and Poland, I went back to my solo career in 1984. And it was Tommy Zimbinski was a promoter. And he was stage crew on that gig at Poznan. And he became a promoter and ran Metal Hammer in Poland. He became the owner of Metal Hammer, or the franchise in Poland.
Right. Because it's interesting to reflect, we're talking about live music, the kind of the live scene massively expanded, didn't it, with the wall coming down and so forth. The number of countries that bands could go to.
Yeah, we really never did that. I mean, that was one of the things. We never played Russia. Well, and then... We never played Estonia at that time. We never played Romania. I don't know what it was, but the currency issues were major. You know, I mean, they were trying to get paid and make things work. But then again, read the autobiography when I get it done. I mean, a lot of it had to do with the fact that the management, you know, we overtoured Europe. We overtoured, you know, when we should have been making inroads into some of these places, we didn't. You know, because we were too busy doing the vacuum trips in Europe. You know,
and how do you know you overtoured? I mean, were the ticket sales going down or something at one point?
No, it was like it was the fact that I mean, it was Morris Jones, the promoter. Remember Morris Jones?
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me after I left the band, he said you were touring far too much, right? And he said you know, we got to the point where it was saturated, you know, and you know. And it was the same across in Germany. We were overplaying in Germany, and when we should have been going out. But it was all to do with the money. It was to do with management percentages, and rather than investing and going into areas, then we weren't. I mean, you know, I never played, you know, Norway. We only ever played Oslo, and that was it. As a solo act, I go up there and I'll do Trondheim, I'll do Bergen. You know, I've done Stavanger. You know, I've even done Tromso, right? And, you know, it was the same in Sweden. We only ever played Stockholm and Gothenburg. Never did anything outside. Denmark, we only ever played Copenhagen. And you know, it was like that's where the money was, rather than going out and playing a day.
And building it up, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And build it, rather just going in and going...
You got to invest at some point, haven't you? And it's difficult to do that because you need to keep the money coming in, don't you?
Yeah, but you also need to tell your productions. You know, and that's what I learned as a solo artist. It's like,
go
you know,
on. What did you learn as a solo artist?
Guerrilla.
It was a live
guerrilla
work.
Touring. Guerrilla touring. I mean, one of the first things, you know, in 1993, Brian Lane, who was ironically the Yes manager.
Yes.
So the circles that occurred in my life were incredible. And, you know, he taught me quite a fair bit about touring. And then, you know, it was like, well, once I got rid of management, I mean, you know, get rid of that 20% management fee as well. That was a big thing. You know, suddenly I was able to go out and play areas that I couldn't really play because I didn't have that 20% stick kicking about. And then once we moved up a little level, a couple of levels, agencies, you know, it was, I mean, nowadays, you know, it's, you know, to find a record company is relatively easy if you want one. The hardest thing to find nowadays is an agent.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Because the only place that bands really make serious money is on the road. Mm-hmm. And finding an agent is difficult. And we learned, you know, we got into with promoters and we found out how to tour. I ran my own label from 1993, you know, and through various incarnations, you know. And we just slimmed it down and it was like, well, rather than being big and massive and unwieldy, you know, we just became like Sioux Indians, right? And it was, and that's what I always said about, you know, like it's the same with the majors, with their approach to albums and the way they promote albums. You know, as an independent record company, as a pure independent, you know, the major corporations basically they kill the buffalo and they take the hide off, and they might take the fillets, and then they'll leave the beast on the field, right? It lies on the prairie. What we do is we go out and we deal it like a Native American, and we basically use every single piece of that beast, right? Right, we find every single way to use everything on that animal, right? And then you move on to the next one, and then you move on to the next one, and that's how you deal with it, right? Mm-hmm. And you never get big, you know. I mean, you know, the last album, my final album, Weltschmerz, we sold only about 25,000 copies, 30,000 copies. I don't actually know for certain, right? But you know, I was making. We got a very comfortable living, and we had a very comfortable living here, right? That I didn't. Yeah. Have. I was in Marillion. Right.
When you talk to the fans, you know, after gigs and stuff in Marillion and stuff, what was it they were connecting with about the songs? Did they tell you what the
people connected to different things? I mean, obviously a lot of people connected to the lyrics, you know. And you know, when I left the band, I mean, the fan base was divided. It wasn't helped by the press at the time, and I don't mean the press and their attitude. It was like, you know, what I was saying and what they were saying in the media, you know. When it was a very public divorce. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, it definitely polarized the fan base still to quite a large degree. I mean, there was obviously crossovers in the Venn diagram effect, you know, in the same way as Gabriel and Genesis. I mean, to bring that back up again, you know.
That's interesting. So do you think you kept some of the fans and there was a kind of like, they kept some of the children, as it were? I mean, is that kind of divorce?
There was an element of that. There was a bunch of people that weren't really into what I was doing. You know, they were into what I was doing back then. But, I mean, I think when Vigil and Season's End came out, you know, it was like, you know, okay, well, where's the scales, you know? And I think especially now, I mean, but then again, there's a lot of, Marillion have picked up a lot of fans now. I mean, they have a lot of people in the church of Marillion that absolutely abhor me, right? I mean, I am the Antichrist.
Really? Still? <Hell yeah. laughs> Do you find that?
I don't care. Yeah.
People always talk about this nowadays, you know, in context of people like Taylor Swift or whatever. You, the obsessive fan, the purest fan who has access to the internet can give people a lot of grief, can't they? Do you get any? You get
I think the internet, especially. Again, the whole Facebook thing is another reason why I'm politely and casually taking a step to the side. Right. I mean, even recently, I mean, you know, we had this thing with the UK tour where we put the dates on sale and, you know, we put the dates up and Glasgow was the last show, right? So everybody went, bam, and Glasgow sold out in 30 hours, 36 hours. And a lot of it was international people, right, that wanted to come to the last show.
Right.
And it was quite creepy, you know. I can understand it. I mean, I can completely understand it. But then we put on another show and then there was...
And so it wasn't the last one anymore.
The last show.
We put on another one. And then people came in and said, how dare you do this? And like, why haven't you put on a show? And it's like, well, and they got really irate. But it was only a few people. But they commanded the stage, right?
I can well imagine.
What they do, this is what happens in a lot of forums, on musicians' forums and things. You get a few people that command center stage. And then anybody that comes up, they're decried, put down, humiliated, right? And, you know, and it's like, blah, blah, blah. And I just went, so, and I'm very straight. And, you know, I just went up and just said my piece. And it's like, it's my tour. I decide when it ends. I decide where it goes. I mean, people were on about, well, we should all vote for the set list. I don't think so.
No. You know, so is that level of complaint?
It was only a very few people.
But it makes a difference.
Small amount of people. but they were commanding the center stage. And you had to basically push them off the stage. And that's what I did. And basically I put a statement up and said, you know, this is, it's my tour, you know? This is the way it goes. If you don't, you know, if you're worried, if you're so adamant about being going to the last gig, buy a ticket for the very last date and sell your ticket. You know, they've already gone. I mean, you know, we've already, I mean, the second night at Glasgow, I think, it's already done 2,200 tickets out of 2,500, you know? And it's a year away. So I don't think anybody's going to have a problem selling tickets, and there's still tickets available. So, like, what's your problem? Right. And I just said, like, you know, don't come along with these gigs where if you don't have the right spirit. Because I'm doing this tour and it's going to be a fun tour and this is my final farewell. You know, it's not a money-making exercise. I want to have fun on this tour. I mean, I'm going out with the guys that I'm going out with. It's a bit like the movie Reds where it's like, you know, we got one more job inside us. And I've got Mickey Simmons back on keyboards, who was there on the Vigil Internal XL tour, one of my main co-writers. Robin Bolt, who's been my guitarist for years. I've got Steve Vance is coming in, who's been my bass player and best friend for a long time and has been there writing with me since the 13 Star album. I've got Liz Troy Artby coming in backing vocals that are co-wrote stuff with, and she's done albums with. It's a really great bunch of people, right? And, you know, and that's what I want in this tour. You know, we're not doing that. You know, I remember going out in Europe and playing gigs and, like, there'd be a poster in the backstage area going, farewell tour of so-and-so, right? And you come back the next year and it's got farewell tour of so-and-so. And I went, I'm not doing that, you know? I want to keep it strict, you know. There's only
Are there going to be elements of it you're going to miss when you give it all up in a year's time?
Yeah, but I mean, God, I mean, you know, there's going to be some bits and pieces, but I mean, what I've got coming at me is, like, you know, I've done it, you know, I've done it. I've ticked it off. I've sold the t-shirts, you know, and it's like, you know, there comes a point. I mean, people always go, why did you leave Marillion and stuff like that? It's like, you know, it was the right time, you know. You can overstay your welcome and you can take that one drink too many or whatever. And it's like, and I just feel that this is the right time. I'm 66 year old in April. And it's like, you know, I don't, you know, in 2015, I was there with Simona, who was my girlfriend at the time in Karlsruhe. And I was splitting my time between Karlsruhe and in Germany and here. And, you know, I remember in 2015, you know, that's when I decided, you know, there's an end game. And I wanted to go out and I wanted to play the Misplaced Children album in its entirety, right? Went on a tour and did that. Then I did the Clutch of the Straws album. And by doing that, that meant that I didn't have to play them on the farewell tour. I didn't have to overindulge myself on Marillion material, right? You know, I'd done it, you know, bam. And then it was like I said, the final album, I knew I had one great album inside me. One great album, you know? And I did it. And that was Weltschmerz. In the same way as when I left Marillion, I left after Clutching at Straws, which I thought was the best album we ever did, right? And that's why people keep on going, well, why did you leave and what would have happened and blah, blah, blah. But I left at that point, and I left after Weltschmerz. And that's when I want to leave touring. You know, I'm 66. My voice is getting it's older. You know, I mean, I've just had two knee replacement knee operations in the last year, so I can do this tour, right? And, you know, and the reality is, you know, it's never, I could write my way tomorrow and it would never get played on radio, right? And it's like, and you know, I'm destined to be on a tour bus traveling from country to country at nights, right? And that is my bit. It will never change. That is the reality of it, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't want to do that. I do not subscribe to that. And
so the plan is you bought a croft in a remote island off of Harris in the Outer Hebrides, haven't you? Tell us about that.
Yeah, but what happened was that, you know, well, I mean, COVID kind of derailed everything. I mean, like, the best laid plans of Mice and Men, Afghan Glaive, et cetera, right? And, you know, the farewell tour should have happened basically a year and a half, 2 years ago, right? I should have been going out with Vigil and Weltschmerz as, you know, Weltschmerz, my final album, Vigil, my first solo album, doing a tour with that, and then doing the farewell tour. And then, but that tour got derailed. And we were sitting here, and my mother was with us for 4 years. I mean, throughout COVID, and so my mother moved in here in 2018, and she was in, my wife and I, we got married in 2017, she moved here in 16, and she loves Scotland. And my mum was here in full-time care with us, and she was staying in our room, and we were living in a back room in the studio. I moved into the studio in 2001, after my first divorce, right? And so my mum's here, we've got the garden outside, you know, and everything was we kind of basically went, maybe we should start thinking about the move. We'd gone across to Germany to see my wife Simona's folks, and it wasn't pleasant, right? For nothing to do with the family, but just the whole journey, right? And then my mum went in respite, and we had 2 weeks, and we thought, well, let's go for a trip. And we were talking about making a move, and it's like, well, if we're going to move, let's move north, right? Let's go north rather than, you know, let's go find space. Because when I moved here in 88, this was a farm in the middle of nowhere. And it's now, it's more like Buckinghamshire now, right? And let's move north. And we got in a car and we said, let's keep our minds open. We drove all the way up to Skye and we went up we were heading up to Bernary. And Bernary is a small island between North Uist and Harris. And on that island, there is one of my really old friends called Keith McIntyre, who's an artist. And he converted or renovated a Telford church there, right? And he'd been on us to come up. And it sounded like Brigadoon, right? Because he said, aye, well, you get the signal, you ride for 6 hours, then you get the ferry, then you get to like this place, and then you take the right, and then you go up there, and you go past the beach, across the causeway, and I'm going like, and it's 7 hours. And I went, oh. And then this thing we went, we're going. And we went up to Bernary, and this is absolutely true, right? He said, we're going to Cayley on the Saturday night. And we arrived in Bernary and I went, wow, this is amazing, right? And we went to Cayley, and I'd never been at a Cayley in my life apart from a Dalkeith High School, which was, it was Scottish Company Dance, and that's what I thought Cayley was. It's not. A Cayley is a coming together of people. It's poetry, it's talking, it's just people coming together. And we went to a Cayley in a byre, right, on North Uist with a sand floor, right, because it was near a beach, right? And it was a charity gig for the air ambulance service, and there was a band playing, and it was just a brilliant time, right? And it was like stepping back into the 70s. The sense of community, the openness, the friendship, everything was just beautiful, right? And I was standing outside where I was, at the time I was smoking, and I was standing outside, and was one of the musicians for the band who knew who I was, right? And there was a woman there, and we were all talking about, my wife is there, da da da. And so it was all, what's your name? And she goes, my name is Cayley.
Oh.
I said, you're kidding me, right? And I said, I'm meeting Cayley at Cayley, right? And we were joking, right? And I said, was your dad a Marillion fan? And she went, no. She said, my mum fancied the singer. She laughed at her. And it was just brilliant when I ran a gator. And then we got talking. My wife and I was sitting there going like, we could maybe move up here. And then Cayley was telling us, like, well, there's places in South Uist that are coming up. And she said, oh, because it was all word of mouth about how the places move. And then Simone and I, right, we drove all the way down to Barra, right the way down all the islands. So we went down through North Uist, Benbecula, South Uist, to Eriskay, to Barra. And we were talking and we were just going like, could we actually move to the Outer Hebrides? And while we were over there, long story very short, well, so someone was looking at the online stuff, and there was a croft came up on Bernary, a 30-acre croft, right? And we were going up there, by the way, to downsize, right? And we were going from an acre garden to 30, right? And we went, and we found out the house, the croft was right next door to Keith, my friend's, right? So it's his church, and then the manse, and then the croft we got. And it's got its own beach, 30 acres, the whole bit, right?
Oh, wow.
And we went, well, let's go. Well, could we go for it? And again, long story short, we went for it, right? And I remember being on the ferry across the Eriskay, talking to my accountant, going like, can I do this? Can we actually manage to put the funds together to get this and renovate and do this whole thing, right? And we were working all that. And I'm standing on the looking up near the bridge of this ferry, and there's a hoolie blowing, right? Aye, we can do it. So we went up. And we kind of worked the numbers out, and it was really touch and go, right? And we came back, and we put the offer in, right? After being spending 2.5 weeks going up and down the Hebrides, right? We put the offer in, and it was kind of accepted, right? And we're still going, and I'm going like, Jesus, right? And then we're right back. 2 days later, after we came back, it was my wife's birthday, And my wife's birthday also happens to coincide with the death of Cayley, right? And Cay died way back. I remember we were in Leamington, and when I got the phone call saying that Cay died, and Cay was like, you know, obviously a very important person in my early part of my life, right? So it was on the anniversary of Kayleigh's death, right, on my wife's birthday, right, 2 days after we put the opera in, and I get a phone call of a guy who used to work with EMI, right, who was now working for an American hedge fund company, right? And he said, would you be interested in selling all your Marillion streaming royalties? And I went, okay. And he said, this is a magic number. And I went, that's a magic
It was meant
number.
To happen.
And it happened, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A coincidence of the planets.
Kayleigh to Kayleigh. Kayleigh is obviously the biggest hit, you know, I ever had with Marillion. Right? And then I tell you another one. So we go back up and we're up there. So we've got the crops and we're having a look about it. And then the bistro up there. There's a wee map, right? And there's at the back of us, at the back of the croft, there's a hill, and it's called Moorhill. I still can't do the Gaelic on it. It's Beersheba, Beersheba. And at the bottom of it, there's a loch, right? So out of the back, we look out the back of the croft, there's a freshwater loch down the bottom of the hill, below the, down the bottom of the slope and below the hill. Golden eagles on the hill, by the way, right? That fly regularly and sit on our house, right?
Fantastic.
And we're going, what's the loch? And we're looking at this wee map on the side of the bistro. And there it was, and it's called the Tara Loch, right? Both Simona and I have got daughters called Tara. My daughter's called Tara, and Simona's daughter, she's got three kids, called Tara, right? And it's just, and it's been like that all the time. Little signs and things happening that are like, what? Right? I mean, there's a woman up on the island that we met who's become a really good friend of ours. She's in her 70s, right? And she's from Woodburn. In Dalkeith, where I come from, right? And this island, by the way, I should stress, there's only 148 people on the island.
Right? I was going to say that's what I wanted to know, 148. So you'll know them all. You'll know them all by name.
Yeah, there's 148 people on the island, and we met Anne, right? And Anne comes from Woodburn, which is from in Dalkeith, where I come from, right? And when she was 16 years old, she tried to buy a motorbike off my granddad.
It that all links up.
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't that extraordinary?
It's incredible.
It is.
It's incredible. And, you know, and it's and Keith McIntyre, by the way, his brother-in-law was John Cavanagh, my first manager. That's how we met, right? It's just all meant to be. And anyway, so we took it on and we just, and we're, that's it, we're going for it. So we bought the, we, you don't buy the crop, you take on the assignation. And we've currently got, and you know, because I mean, it's serious. I mean, we're not doing the Jeremy Clarkson bit. I mean, this is we're it's like we love it. I mean, we you know, it's like I said, we were told.
So you're going to farm it. You're going to have sheep.
Yeah, we've got 13 sheep already. Right, we've got 13 black-faced, what they call gimmers, which are 1-year-old ewe lambs. Right, this is crazy, right? So when we do the European tour, we come back from the European tour and go up to the island because we'll be living there permanently by then, and that's when our 13 gimmers go to the ram, right?
Mm.
And then when we come back off the UK tour in March, that's just about when the lambing starts.
Right?
So we got 13 black-faced gimmers at 1 year old. And I'm learning when I was really young. My mum and dad, they had a wee house, a kind of wee holiday place up on a hill farm just down in the borders because my mum and dad were big friends of the farmers. And I used to go up there and I was around lambing and around all that stuff when I was really young. Then I was in forestry. We're putting a woodland up in the croft as well, right? And then, but the gimmers, they've got 13 of them, right? And they've all got to get names, right? And it's Harriet Brownlee Shadler, Stanton Black Blackley, Edwards, O'Rourke, Gordon, Cropley, Duncan, Hamilton, Hazel, which is the Hibernian team from 1972. But we don't know which one's which yet.
Who's playing up front?
The Hibernian team from when? When was that?
It's the Hibernian team from 1972.
That's amazing.
Oh, that's great.
But yeah,
very
but
good.
The thing was that everybody said, "Well, you're going to have to get sheep," and we went, "Yeah, well, we're going to do it serious." And like I said, I'd been around sheep, but I knew nothing about them.
Yeah.
And I googled it and I went like, okay. And I wrote, I had to get books, and I went, "Our Idiot's Guide to Sheep," right? And it said, like, the first thing you need is not sheep, you need a sheep guru. And luckily, our next-door neighbour was a lovely man called Duncan, and he'd been running his sheep on our crop, because our crop's never been worked for 25 years. It's basically derelict, right? And we've taken it over, and we're bringing the whole thing back to life. That's the idea. I've got a 5-ton JCB up there. for the drainage. I know about fencing from forestry days. We've got the 13 sheep. We've got everything sorted out. I'm putting in a polycrub, which is like an armadillo polytunnel, because the winds are 80 mile an hour up there. During the
it winter. Will be, my yeah. God.
And then we've got a dry stain dike around this old steading, and we're putting a garden in there. And we've got air source heat pumps and solar panels. We've got about, I think it's 12K of solar panels we're putting up on the farm or on the croft. So, I mean, we're trying to be as self-sufficient as possible. We're going to grow some money.
Well, this is a brilliant project.
Yeah, my wife's
brilliant project.
And the White House, which is the old kind of late 19th, early 20th century building. It's a one and a half story, two up, two down, right? That's kind of like a working space. And my wife's going to run a little cafe there. Because basically you walk out our front door, you walk 10 minutes across the pasture, and you're on our, we own a big chunk of the White Sand Beach. And there's loads of caravans and stuff come there. They're not going to stay overnight.
Fantastic.
During the day. Because on Bernary, I don't know if you know about this, right? There's a beach, 3.5 mile long, White Sand Beach. And on Lonely Planet, about a month ago.
It was voted the best beach, wasn't it, in the
world.
Hebrides?
Oh,
in
really?
The world. That's right, the best beach in the world. Yeah.
And we're on the East Beach.
Yeah,
well, look, Mark and I are very great fans of the islands, so we'll come and see you when you get it all sorted out.
I mean, it's going to be sad because, like I said, Simona wants to run a little part-time restaurant, open two nights a week, and then run the cafe and stuff. I run the vegetables, I run the crop, and I'm writing. I mean, you know, because, I mean, basically, you know, everybody goes, well, yeah, Fish the Singer. I'm not. Hey, number one, I'm Derek up there. Nobody calls me Fish. Nobody. Yeah.
Right.
And it's like, I have always been a writer who can sing. I've never been, you know, I've never been a good technical singer, right? I am a writer who can sing, not a singer that can write. And that's what I want to do up there. It's like, you know, up till now, it's either a tour or an album's always got in the way of sitting down, writing. And that's
well, I was going to say that for most people who are kind of retiring, there's always that slight danger that there won't be enough of a project ahead and you'll be sitting around the house.
I think there will be.
Missing the Retford Border House. But in your case, you've clearly got a major thing on your head. It's fantastic. Yeah,
this is it. I mean, people are going like, they're talking about some sad old bastard going, you know, like, oh, so you'll be playing golf then? No.
No.
I mean, I was told, and this is the really wicked thing, I was talking about the Gala Shields when I put my first band. Way back when I was in forestry, and I didn't realize at the time, but I was suffering from depression, right? There's a lot of things I've learned about myself in the last 3-4 years, right? But I knew I was really down about everything, right? And I was told to see this palm reader, this Iranian palm reader, who was like reputedly very, very good. And the guy, I mean, he actually committed suicide because he couldn't deal with what he was finding out about people. And he couldn't deal with telling people things that he could see, right? Anyway, that's another by-the-by story. So I saw this Iranian palm reader, right? And he said, you're going to have three careers in your life, right? And he said, the first one you're in now. And he said, you're about to leave it, right? And this is in 1980, right? And he said, the next career you're going to go into, he said, you've never seriously thought about taking it on. I said, it's completely different from the one you're in. But he said, the second career is going to make you world famous and you're going to become very well known and you're going to make money and stuff, blah, 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 right? And basically, 6 months after that, I joined Marillion, right? And he said, there's a third career. And he said, the third career is completely different from the second, right? Completely different from the second. And he said, that one is going to be even more famous, right? And he said, that's going to take you to another level. And he said, it's completely different from the second and completely different from the first, right? And he said, you'll always know when the right time and when things are moving because you'll get signs. He said, things will happen that are meant to happen that will just gently guide you into where you're supposed to be, right? And look at where I am now.
Well, we're going to wish you a huge amount of luck with it. And it's a fantastic project. Brilliant to talk to you.
Yeah.
And
great to see you two guys again.
Good luck with the tour.
Good luck with the croft. It's the first time I've ever said this to anyone.
Absolutely.
Word down your way. Those who are about to tour salute you.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Small details are big surfaces. tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.